From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. A State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you. Thank you sincerely. We have to have your support. Now, if you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
He would work every day to make sure that the Lord's word governed our actions each and every day. We will continue to fight these battles. It is a never-ending struggle until the rapture. Be part of it. Be in the fight.
It can sometimes feel like our ongoing conversation about the threats posed by the political religious rights influence in our culture and government is happening parallel to, but unrecognized by, more mainstream concerns about the times we live in. That all changes when a medium as secular as the Financial Times publishes something like a recent article headlined Pompeo's Global Rapture Tour. This shines a secular spotlight on some of the most disturbing aspects of the administration's disregard for church-state separation, and I'll talk to the writer Edward Luce later in the hour.
This expert said swastika is a universal symbol of evil, he said. And I asked the question, what do you mean by universal? we use it. Although West, that's probably evil symbol because of the Nazis Germany, but yet, originally, Buddhist, we use it. Hindu, we use it. Also, Jain, use it. And most of the Eastern country, we use as a very, very important symbol.
A comprehensive look at this history has just been published in the form of a book titled The Buddhist Swastika and Hitler's Cross, Rescuing a Symbol of Peace from the Forces of Hate, and the author will be with us on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
Monday is Martin Luther King Day, a celebration of the groundbreaking civil rights leader's life and legacy. Signed into law by Ronald Reagan in 1983, it took certain states of the Union a lot longer to grudgingly honor King. South Carolina didn't fully recognize the federal holiday until 2000. And in Alabama, Arkansas, and Mississippi, the third Monday in January is still also observed as Robert E. Lee Day. Not the best of combinations, I would say. Now, all of this predates the escalation of exclusionary, divisive, and hateful rhetoric, both from our political leadership and many everyday Americans. And so this actually may be the most important Martin Luther King Day yet. Joining me now is the Reverend Michael Ray Matthews, Deputy Director of Faith in Action and President of the Alliance of Baptist Board of Directors. That's an organization I'm proud to say that I helped found some time back. Reverend Matthews has spent decades writing and teaching on the theology of resistance, something that we need to highlight in preparation for January 21st. Reverend Matthews, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Wilton, for having me on this podcast. This is the first podcast I ever listened to, so it's exciting to be a guest on the podcast and to be with someone who I get to stand in the tradition of as a president of the Alliance.
Well, thank you. To me, nothing crystallizes the heartbreak of the past few years as much as the reverse progress that we've seen on the issues that Dr. King devoted his life to addressing. Would you agree with that?
I do think it has been eye-opening and demoralizing to watch what has happened over the decades. I turned 50 last year. I was born just months after Dr. King was assassinated. And my parents raised me for a different 2019 than the one that we are facing now, that I would be in the streets fighting for voting rights when our grandparents were supposed to have won those rights. It's amazing, and it's demoralizing to see the progress that we thought we've made to find so many things, so much retrenchment, and to see so many things undone. It reminds us of, I think it reminds us of the reality that the struggle that we are in is one that is continuous and that it requires our heartfelt commitment and hard and prophetic action.
You mentioned the voting rights challenge that we're facing. In which other areas do you see the greatest losses after all the progress that we had made as a nation in the past 50 years?
Well, I think one of the things that I think I have typically framed as a loss, but have in recent years sort of reframed my thinking about, has to do with how we understand the work around racial justice and racial healing. I think that we believed in a narrative that coming out of the civil rights movement that suggested that the future for us as it related to race relations would be markedly different, that we would actually be closer to the beloved community that we envisioned out of that season in American history. And in some ways, a lot of folks felt, you know, not too long ago that the election of President Barack Obama represented, you know, a sort of, you know, a high mark in that sort of projection of history and progress. And I think in some ways the election actually revealed that that the power of race, the construct of race, is insidious. And that it lives inside of our psyches, it lives in our relationships, it lives in our structures and systems, and it lives in the broader culture, and we breathe it like particulates in the air, and it affects so much of how our lives are shaped. And in some ways, the election actually helped to reveal what was just beneath the surface for so many of us. So if we had accepted that narrative, that frame, that we were on a trajectory of progress, it is quite disappointing and demoralizing to see what we're facing even now. And at the same time, I think it reminds us of just how vigilant we have to be towards the goal of building beloved community, of pursuing racial healing and justice in the world.
Yeah. Again and again, public polling shows that white Americans simply do not believe the challenges that minorities in this country are facing in law enforcement, voting rights, and other vitally important areas of daily life, dignity, and safety. How can we begin to increase understanding across this deep divide? Or is that too polite a way to try to move forward, waiting for people to understand, and instead to make it impossible for people to keep ignoring the situation?
Right. Well, I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, the theology of resistance. We've been cultivating this multi-faith discourse inside of the Faith in Action community for 5 years now. Well, going on 5 years at the end of this year. And we have taken very seriously the realities that It will require deep, uncommon encounters across difference to address this kind of work. It will require that we disrupt narratives that erase the pain and suffering of people who are directly impacted by injustice in our communities. It will require that we cultivate a powerful moral imagination that allows for us to create new narratives together about what it means for us to be a beloved community. And it will require that we take prophetic action, that we not only have to engage in the kind of organizing that allows for us to change laws and to create the systems and structures necessary, but also to take the kind of prophetic action that allows for us to build the kinds of relationships that are transformative.
You've been at the forefront of teaching the theology of resistance. I see that as a prophetic continuation of Dr. King's work. Yeah. And honestly, that's why I wanted to have you with us this week in particular. So, Michael Ray, what are the precepts of this theology?
Sure. So this is a multi-faith model for theological and ethical reflection on our vision and our realizing of beloved community in the world. It was developed in the context of the Ferguson Uprising, and it began with a very provocative question that came actually out of a group of clergy and leaders who organized in Cincinnati, Ohio, with the Amos Project, one of our members. And the question was, are you a chaplain to the empire or a prophet of the resistance? The question to clergy about the ways in which our leadership can either shore up and reinforce the oppressive elements of empire, or our leadership can actually be in the heritage of the prophets who offered a different vision of what it meant for us to be community and who actively resisted any injustice in the world. And so we've in the context of the Ferguson Uprising, we're deeply challenged by that question as faith leaders, and began to develop, coming out of that, a model and a tool to help us construct counter narratives to the logic and impulse of empire, and to begin to tell the kinds of stories that allow for us to cultivate a moral imagination. One of the principles in the model is that if you're not cultivating a moral imagination, you're probably living inside someone else's. Mm. So what does it mean for us to be committed to working together to answer the hard questions, questions like the question that Dr. King's mentor, Dr. Howard Thurman, asked in 1949, what does your faith have to say to those who stand with their backs against the wall? So people of faith and moral courage have to wrestle with that question on a regular basis, because there are so many people standing now in this moment with their backs against the wall. And there must be a theology, there must be an ethic, there must be a spirituality that informs our decision to resist injustice and to stand with those whose backs are against the wall, and to change the conditions of life for people who stand with their backs against the wall. This is critical if we want to actually realize beloved community, that we have to say no to empire and say yes to what it means to be human community together, to undo the hierarchy of human value that racism represents, to dispel the myth of scarcity in our communities and the unjust control of resources, and to defeat the power of hyper-individualism and isolation that keeps us from connecting to one another and seeing our pain as connected to one another and seeing our destiny as connected to one another. Building beloved community will require that we dismantle empire together. And that's what the theology of resistance is all about.
Let's talk more about the theology of resistance.
Certainly. One of the big worries I had when we were developing this model was the ways in which resistance can at times suggest that this is about what we're against and not what we're for, which is why I've been very careful to sort of articulate from the beginning of any discussion about this discourse that what we're after is beloved community, and that we've had to recognize, because we've been so So deeply impacted by what has happened in recent years, you know, beginning with Ferguson, we've been so deeply impacted by that. We're realizing that there's more we have to do than simply say that we are proponents of beloved community. We have to be clear about the honest ways in which we have to face the realities of racism, which requires that we actually learn how to say no. Not just yes, but also no, so that we're actually free to say a yes that actually matters. So that's one thing I want to say, is that I think the theology of resistance is a positive, forward-looking theological model, but it takes seriously the kinds of things we have to let go of in order to be able to embrace the vision of beloved community. And, of course, the model itself is a theological and ethical model, and so one of the primary practices of this work that we're doing collectively around the theology of resistance is to begin to share stories. And we start with our own stories of how we've encountered injustice in our communities, encountered injustice in our families, how the disruption of that injustice required for us to reimagine how we were going to behave in the world. For myself, I tell the story of what happened when I went to Ferguson as a part of a delegation of leaders in our organization who spent 3.5 months there. And the more and more I heard the stories of pain of young people in the community, the more and more I learned about the disparities in terms of health and education and housing, the more that I began to understand the deep disconnect between young African-American youth and African-American faith communities and clergy leaders, not just in Ferguson, but in all the Fergusons across the country. I myself, as a product of the Black Church, as an ordained Baptist minister, had to come to grips with the deep responsibility that I had to reimagine how I was going to live in the world vis-a-vis these young people and other young people like them. And it was that story. It's that story that sort of animates my commitment to a new way of living in the world, a new way of conducting ministry, a new way of training faith leaders and spiritual leaders who are a part of our work. The other kinds of stories, so that's my personal story. The other kinds of stories that we explore are the stories that are actually in our sacred texts. So our sacred texts are rife with stories of people who encountered injustice, who were disrupted by that injustice, and had to reimagine how they were going to be in the world as a result of what they encountered. So I might tell the story of Esther, who was quite clear about the rules that prevented her from being able to confront the king about the challenges and the threat of annihilation of her people in the empire. And the decision that she had to make, that disruption required her to reimagine herself as someone who could actually take action and resist the logic and impulse of empire so that she could actually be an agent of salvation for her people. I think the stories in our Christian New Testament are rife with examples of ways in which Jesus himself disrupted the status quo, created ways for people to reimagine themselves in the world, and take prophetic action together. So the theology of resistance is a biblical model. It's a model that's not only biblical in terms of the Judeo-Christian tradition, but we have leaders from the Sikh tradition, from Islam, from Judaism, from Christianity, from Unitarian Universalism, from Hinduism, who are all bringing to the table the stories from their traditions, the practices from their traditions, the rituals and song and poetry from their traditions that point us in the direction of what it means to resist the logic and impulse of empire and to faithfully together pursue the vision of beloved community.
Where do you see groundbreaking work being done to resist the unholy tendencies that are weighing on our nation's soul right now? Where, I guess the question is, where do you draw hope from?
Well, I tell you, I find hope in the everyday work of everyday people across this country. You know, Faith in Action is an international network. We're in four countries, and in the U.S. we're in 22 states. And particularly in the United States, I know that, like, every day there are everyday people waking up and building relationships, learning more about how power operates in their communities, and are organizing their congregations and their communities for real change. There are people who are trying to dismantle the ways in which our criminal justice system makes it impossible for people to find real redemption. I find hope when I think about my brother Desmond Meade, who in Florida, through his organization, the Florida Rights Restoration Commission, in partnership with our organization Faith in Florida and many other groups, were able to achieve the seemingly impossible feat of restoring the rights to vote to millions of formerly incarcerated people in that state. I find hope when, you know, people have the kind of faith to disrupt the logic and impulse of empire, to organize their communities, reimagine a future, and to actually achieve the kind of changes in our laws and changes in our relationships that allow for us to get closer to that vision. And that Desmond is just one example of someone who had a dream 7 years ago and stuck with it, and organized thousands and thousands of people of faith to see it come to fruition. And that is happening in cities and towns all across this country, and in many other countries as well, as people of faith and moral courage are staying committed to what it means to be a person of faith.
What do you want each person hearing this to keep in their minds and in their hearts this Martin Luther King Day?
I think that the most important thing I would lift up, or that I would pray for in this season, is that people would take seriously the power of imagination, the power of what it means to cultivate a moral imagination, and to do that work of cultivating a moral imagination together in community. I think if we can't see it together, we're not going to realize it.
Reverend Michael Ray Matthews is Deputy Director at Faith and Action, formerly PICO Network, and President of the Alliance of Baptist Board of Directors. Reverend Matthews has spent decades writing and teaching on the theology of resistance. He is now an Auburn Seminary Senior Fellow. Thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It is indeed a deep honor to have this conversation with you, and I appreciate so much the power of your witness and your leadership in this movement, Walton.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Financial Times writer Edward Luce will be with us to discuss his article, Pompeo's Global Rapture Tour. And later, the author of the new book, The Buddhist Swastika and Hitler's Cross, Rescuing a Symbol of Peace from the Forces of Hate, T.K. Nakagaki. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Pompeo's Global Rapture Tour. Now, for those of us familiar with Christian end times theology, that's a chilling phrase. Unexpectedly, it's the headline of an article in the sober Financial Times, and I am thankful to be able to welcome the author, journalist Edward Luce, to State of Belief Radio. Ed, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, Welton, it's a pleasure to be with you.
What's the alarming point you're making in this Financial Times column?
So I used a slightly provocative headline that you kindly mentioned, Pompeo's Global Rapture Tour, because I was quite struck by the content of his speech in Cairo last week to a Muslim audience, largely, you know, in a very large Muslim country, Egypt, in which he begins with a declaration of his evangelical faith, his Christian faith, and essentially uses the speech to trash Barack Obama's famous speech in Cairo in 2009, 10 years earlier. And I think that it was a worryingly tone-deaf speech, not the speech of a diplomat, but the speech of somebody who's intending his real audience to be the stronger evangelical sort of voter back in the United States. And I thought this was both rash, undiplomatic, and it also prompted me to delve a little bit more into his theology.
How are they playing out in Pompeo's public performance?
So Pompeo's a very ambitious man, and he makes no secret. I think those who know him around him make no secret of the fact that he would like to be president of the United States. And I think that his base politically when he was in Congress had a very, very strong Christian component. And I think it's not that dissimilar to the vice president of Mike Pence's political base. Both, of course, very, very different from Donald Trump's persona.
Where do you see these beliefs shared with Vice President Pence and other top administration officials?
I worry about them. I'm very much not anti-Christian. My mother is actually a deacon in the Church of England. And, you know, I have the greatest respect and affection for mainstream theology. I worry that this quite sort of apocalyptic end of times vision that these sort of harder core evangelicals such as Pompeo and Pence have isn't something that we can be confident will be confined to their private lives and their private beliefs. I think if you're vice president, potentially the next president, or your secretary of state, potentially the next president, that it's hard to imagine that idea about the direction of humanity in which, you know, there is a rapture where the righteous are saved and the unrighteous are not, is never going to color your perspective of your actions as a statesman. And just to give one example of this, the move of the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem was very much done for the domestic, American domestic, hardline evangelical audience, the Christian Zionists. And I don't think you could make any case whatsoever that that move has advanced the interests of Arab-Israeli peace. I think it's actually been a very retrograde step.
Talk, if you will, a bit more about the direct policy decisions that these beliefs would be likely to drive, if you would. I mean, everything from indifference to the climate crisis to international relations can be parsed in terms of the world is ending soon anyway.
So that's a very good question, and I'm glad you mentioned climate change. Because if you've got an eschatology that tells you that the world is coming to an end, perhaps within our lifetimes, and that is the righteous, ordained conclusion to the human story, the second coming of Christ, then trends that are pushing us that way, such as the breakdown of the global climate, could be divinely ordained. Why would you take steps to slow down? What is God's plan? And, you know, I think this is a very live and deeply troubling example of the kinds of seeping in of private belief into public stance. And, of course, neither man, Pence nor Pompeo, has taken any serious stance on global warming. I think that's a very troubling consequence, potential consequence. I can't prove this. I'm raising questions.
The influence of theocratic faith leaders from the political religious right on the Trump administration are pretty well known. But when it comes to actual cabinet members, who else do you see as likely influenced by end times beliefs?
So I haven't done a detailed sort of theological or sort of investigation, if you like, into the cabinet principles in the Trump administration. But, you know, just on the surface, very clearly, Ben Carson, the HUD secretary, is very much sort of influenced by, I think, quite extreme theological ideas. I cannot be sure, but I think Rick Perry, the energy secretary, former governor of Texas, is very much in that world. I think Betsy DeVos, the secretary for education, is quite closely connected to that world. And I think there are a lot of people inside the White House, you know, who don't hold cabinet positions, who are influenced by that. Clearly, the vice president's office is the strongest locus of it, though.
I know your column is just a brief thought piece, and that you cite the Guardian newspaper for exposing the degree to which the apocalypse is imminent in the mind of the U.S. Secretary of State. But I thought it was encouraging to see this addressed in a publication like the Financial Times. And I wanted to get your take on how seriously this is being taken in the greater secular community. Because for us, it's been a great source of concern. Are readers worried? What's the feedback that you're getting?
Well, to judge by the response to my column, which went sort of fairly widespread, there was a lot of dissemination and chatter around it, as indeed there was around Julian Borges' original article reporting in the Guardian. Mine was a column. It was, I think, deliberately provocative to try and draw attention to this issue. I think that people are less ignorant than they were before within what you call the secular community about the theology of the Secretary of State. But I don't think people are yet taking it seriously enough. And I think it's very important, you know, particularly as we see a potential conclusion to Trump's presidency, perhaps before his time, with the sort of hammer blow of revelations most recently about him suborning perjury from Michael Cohen, his former personal lawyer, on the Moscow Tower. That we pay greater attention to the theology of the man who would take his job, Mike Pence, and the man who would want to take his job, one after that, which is Mike Pompeo.
Edward Luce is an English journalist and the Financial Times chief U.S. commentator and columnist based in Washington, D.C. His books include Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Dissent, and The Retreat of Western Liberalism. The Financial Times column is headlined Pompeo's Global Rapture Tour. Ed, I'm not going to say your work has much of a feel-good factor, but I think it's inestimably important, and I really want to thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio. You're welcome back again.
It's a great honor to be on, Weldon. Thank you so much for inviting me.
The Reverend T.K. Nakagaki is someone whom I've known and respected for many years. In fact, he was on the board of Interfaith Alliance, and he and I had many opportunities to get to know each other and exchange ideas. He is a leader in the Buddhist community and a prominent interfaith leader. He's now the author of a comprehensive new book titled The Buddhist Swastika and Hitler's Cross, Rescuing a Symbol of Peace from the Forces of Hate. I congratulate you on the publication of the book, and I welcome you to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much.
Why has it been so important for you to wade into what is, for many, controversial waters?
I entered the New York Theological Seminary in 2010, So at that time, the first thing they asked me is, so what do you want to write about for the dissertation? But I didn't have exactly what I wanted to do there, because the only thing I wanted to study was like an interface. I did a lot of interface activities, but I never studied at that point. So that's why I entered the New York Theological Seminary. But then the year before that I entered the New York Theological Seminary, at the Interface Center of New York, as you involved many times. Okay. So they always have a Marshall Mayer retreat, like overnight retreat. And so they discuss, different topics. But one of the year before 2009, I believe, was hate crime is the topic. And then so, as expected, as the speakers and so forth. And then the expert comes and religious leaders come, about, 100 religious leaders are gathered. And, multi-face gathering. At that time was overnight. So it was an intensive kind of gathering. People talk about different things. And one of the speakers, expert of the hate crime, said, swastika is the universal symbol of evil. I know this is a symbol for evil in this Western world, but when you say universal symbol, that's a different meaning. I mean, universal evil symbol, symbol mm-hmm. evil. And then I actually asked the question to the speaker, what do you mean by universal? The Buddhists use it, Hindu use it, all the Asian culture, the swastika is a good symbol. And maybe even include Native American used to use it here in this country. And I asked the question, and this particular speaker, he didn't know anything about it, but then he said universal symbol of evil. And if the expert is this much, what about all the other people? Mm-hmm. And then actually after the discussion, Hindu people, Native American people, Jain people, or Buddhist people, we're sort of gathering. We should do something about this. Is a little bit too much to say. It's not the universal symbol of evil. It just happened to be because of the Nazi Germany. Only 100 years ago, it became like that. But before, or even now too, is a good symbol in Asia most of the time. And it's like a symbol 2,000 years, or it could be 5,000 years as a good symbol.
And TK, what was the definition of the symbol of the swastika originally? How would you define it?
Yeah, that's a Sanskrit term, first of all. Su as, the Skavati, like a Pure Land, Su is a good, very extremely good meaning. So good or welfare, or, so it's the symbol of the peace or symbol of the, really the sun, symbol of the sun originally. And so Swasti is like a state of good or doing good. Mm-hmm. And Ka make the, noun.
So why was it misappropriated by groups such as the Nazis in Germany?
But probably they didn't really use for the bad meaning, first of all. But they use as a cross, actually, first of all. So the symbol swastika is one thing. But then at least the word swastika, Hitler never used it. He never says swastika anyway, first of all. Mm. He always used a German language, of course, and called Hakenkreuz. If you translate, that's a hooked cross. So that's why it's an anti-Semitism symbol, right? I mean, the cross has a history for many years with anti-Semitism, with the part. So it is a cross. So that's why the Hitler's cross is a title that I use. Because a swastika does not have nothing to do with a cross, actually. Mm-hmm. That came from the, as I said, the Sanskrit term, and so nothing to do with it. And so that was really, even the English itself is totally wrong. And if you say that's a, the evil symbol, it should be start from D, like a devil and so forth. So it should be dvastika instead of swastika. Yeah. So it's always a good meaning.
Well, your book has glowing endorsements from rabbis, theologians, teachers, and others. What kinds of conversations have you had with various people along the way in completing this book? And has there been feedback that impacted your understanding of this symbol?
Yeah, actually, this is something interesting for me. I mean, as I do, although I start doing this one, one thing I said, this particular swastika, I'm not too sure. I'm not expert of the swastika when I started, actually. Meaning, I know it's a Buddhist symbol. You use it for the map and every place. If you go to Japan, you find the swastika all over the place. We call it manji anyway, which is a character of good fortune. So a character of all the virtues. So that's the symbol. And then the symbol is used for the Buddhism or Buddhist temple specifically. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's basically all that I know. but I never really study for the swastika itself. So this is a good opportunity for me to even find it. And the strange thing for me was American people, if you go to Japan, you see all the swastika symbol. For Japanese people, we don't see nothing, actually. First thing that I really have to find is, where is the swastika? It should be somewhere all over the place, but then we never pay attention to it. Because in Japan, 1,400 years, swastika is in Japan. So it's like a sign of we don't see anything. For me, this is a finding gravity. You don't see the gravity, but yet, like a Newton found thing, right? So for my eyes, we don't see nothing, and I just found it. So it's a very interesting for me awareness of how this symbol was hidden in a way. But then there are so many places in Japan, and then I realized this is such a great symbol, important symbol of the old, many part of the not only Buddhism. Actually, I realized later on was a very interfaith symbol. And probably the most interfaith symbol ever used in a human history for many, many years and many, many people and many, many revisions. However, of course, as you know, interfaith nowadays, one of the symbols we never be able to use is the most interfaith symbol. So that's why it's kind of challenging for me to bring it.
Well, I think you know there are neo-Nazi groups even today that are actively using the swastika as a symbol of division and superiority. Does an honest look at this symbol's history weaken its usefulness to hate groups?
Right. So for me, it's not the one important point for me is it's not the 100% evil, but there is a different side of the swastika itself. Although no school ever really teach those things, but then truth is a truth. I mean, it's not, you just don't worry to covering up. This is the evil symbol, has to be evil symbol. That's the way it is right now. But why you can't just acknowledge the symbol itself? It's of course a good aspect. It could be used for the wrong way, and that's all. It's not one thing is right and wrong, but rather the one thing could be right and wrong, and then has many parts of it that this symbol itself has. So basically, what I'm trying to do is education, because I know that some people went to Japan, they even afraid to ask this particular question: why this symbol is there? But then nobody explained it in the West. We don't know. And nowadays, a lot of people go to travel to all over the world. And then some of the symbol, maybe fear them and so forth. That's not nice either. And so in a way, what I try to do is simply educational part. So, we should know these are symbol also used for many, many years and as a very good symbol for many, many people. Of course, Nazi Germany, even that time, 1900, whether you realize or not, in the United States, those symbol swastika was introduced. And actually, Smithsonian support to get the research for it, which is started like a 19, what's his name, Schliemann, the Henry Schliemann, who destroyed, discovered the Troy. So that when they, the digging all those places, then the swastika show up. Wondering what's going on this particular symbol. So when they introduced, swastika was introduced as a good meaning, like a 4L. There's a 4L you can see, right? So that's why they interpret it as love, light, life, and luck, like a good luck. Hmm. So it's all, but that's really more like a meaning of the swastika itself. And then somehow, after Hitler used and all those things, it changes the totally meaning But so you know, it's just simple fact. It's nothing, you know, I'm not talking about something created or try to change anything, but rather you should know when we discuss anything, we need to have information, and then we can discuss what we should be doing, or is this something that we have to consider? Or, you know, when you teach like Hitler's part, is it better to talk about this? Because otherwise, you don't really see why the swastika is anti-Semitism symbol. Because Hitler used it? No.
Good. Yes.
Something is right. Hidden. We never call it the cross as a cross of the thing. So that's why it's a little sensitive for the, you know, Christian side of it. But yet that's the fact. And then the revision was used for many different ways. So it's a good discussion, even that itself. Why do you want to hide, you know, that the cross can, I mean, cross can be hidden by the swastika, actually, shape. And then that happened. It was interesting in Japan, too, when the Christian, the, you know, was a practice, they used the cross for the swastika. Sure.
When you were writing, did you ever think, what would I like every reader of this book to feel when they put it down?
Maybe whatever you see, the information and so forth you may have, may be totally wrong. And then so you can really start seeing everything is a little more critical way of looking at. And don't just say, that's the way school teaches, but then maybe you wanted to really see what's really happening there. And that's probably very critical thinking. Is very important. You know, like especially Facebook time nowadays,
we read
a lot of articles, but is that really true what they're saying? Or the picture itself is true what they're saying? And so you really have the kind of a thinking of is this really true? What is really what should be doing it? And so that kind of a training of your eyes to see the truth, and then so that's something that I want people to realize. So don't attach to one view or the other view, but then try to open your mind and then open your heart, and then possibly to see what you see really is the one that I want you to, or the reader to be feeling.
Dr. T.K. Nakagaki is a Buddhist priest who is president of the Buddhist Council of New York. He is the former vice president of the Interfaith Center of New York. He has been very faithful in supporting Interfaith Alliance and serving as a board member there for several years. His new book is titled The Buddhist Swastika and Hitler's Cross, Rescuing a Symbol of Peace from the Forces of Hate. TK, I am so glad that you were able to get this book published, and I thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Very nice to see you, and I hope to see you sometimes physically this time and discuss a little bit more. And so peace to you and a Happy New Year.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support of this program helps keep us on the air week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you on our behalf, but let me say an even bigger thank you on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.